My name's Torin Finney, and I'm not on the regular teaching staff. I work in Narnia, but I published had a book published recently on a World War I CO, and I was asked to lead a class on not only his story in particular, but the conscientious objection issue in general. And I've chosen to title it "The Conscientious Objector Then and Now," and I have four parts basically that I want us to talk about. One is an introductory, an introduction in which I'm going to read a few things to you. And secondly, we'll talk a little bit about the historical background in this country, starting with the very beginnings and bringing us up to the present. Third, I want to talk a little bit about the different responses of Christians in wartime and some of the theological issues around that. And then fourth, there's some related issues that I'd like to talk a little bit about. And since we only have an hour, for the sake of time, maybe we can hold our questions till I'm done with each section, and then we can have a discussion time right after each section. So once again, there's four sections. I'd like to start with an excerpt from this biography that I wrote. This is a letter written by this fellow. His name was Ben Salmon. He was a Catholic CO in World War I. And this is the letter he wrote to President Woodrow Wilson after he registered for the draft, explaining his position. And this was his first public statement regarding the issue. This was right as the U.S. was entering World War I, right after the Conscription Act had been passed. Denver, Colorado, June 5th, 1917. His Excellency Woodrow Wilson, President of the United States, Washington, D.C. My dear Mr. Wilson, complying with your edict, I registered today. Your mandate was autocratic and contrary to the Constitution. Nevertheless, acquiescence caused injustice against no one but myself. Consequently, I submitted. But I must now tell you that I refuse to submit to conscription. And then excuse the sexist language here in this next part. Regardless of nationality, all men are my brothers. God is our Father who art in heaven. The commandment, thou shalt not kill, is unconditional and inexorable. If the parent orders the child to do wrong, the child should disobey. If the state commands the subject to violate God's law, the subject should ignore the state. Man is interior to the state, and God is supreme. Both by precept and example, the lowly Nazarene taught us the doctrine of non-resistance, and so convinced was he of the soundness of that doctrine that he sealed his belief with death on the cross. The great mass of people still adhere to Christ's teachings against war, regardless of the fact that cardinals, priests, and ministers have repudiated the Christian ideal and bowed to the God of expediency. There are many ways to avoid war. Now that you are in it, there are many ways to get out of it, without sacrificing or threatening to sacrifice a single life. The solution of the problem, without breaking the commandments of God, is merely a question of desire and determination. Aside from right or wrong, why concern ourselves about German injustice while unmindful of the disorder of our own house? In America, millions of impoverished citizens vainly send forth their mute appeal for justice. Their supplications are answered with greater tyranny, renewed iniquities, and a further disregard of their rights and their liberties. Show me any German cruelty that can outdo in horror the massacre of the women and children in the tent colony at Ludlow, Colorado. And the underlying cause of the Ludlow tragedy manifests itself daily through the length and breadth of this land of liberty, although it is only when given spontaneous expression that we even notice the misery and sorrow and seething despair that is slowly eating out the heart of our boasted civilization in America. Why not correct the wrongs at home? Quote, hypocrite, cast first the beam out of thine own eye, and then shalt thou see clearly to take out the mote from thy brother's eye. St. Luke chapter 6, verse 42. I am not an alien sympathizer. I was born in Denver of Canadian-American parents, and I love America. This letter is not written in a contumelious spirit. But when human law conflicts with divine law, my duty is clear. Conscience, my infallible guide, impels me to tell you that prison, death, or both are infinitely preferable to joining any branch of the army and contributing, either directly or indirectly, to the death of my fellow working men. I voted for you and worked for your election in 1916, and I'm still faithful in you. Hopeful that you may see the right and have the courage to follow it, I am sincerely yours, Ben J. Salmon. And there were several other letters like this which he sent in the course of his imprisonment, which followed soon thereafter. The other thing I wanted to read to you is a more recent statement, and I was struck by the similarities between the two. Remember, this first one that I just read to you is 1917, and this one is dated August 29, 1987. It's written by Charles Maresca, Jr., who's the Associate Director for Counseling of the National Interreligious Service Board for Conscientious Objectors in Washington. And this was part of an article from the New York Times. So, for the record, here is what conscientious objectors object to. We object to killing. We object to killing in the name of capitalism. We object to killing in the name of communism. We object to killing in the name of religion. We object to being forced to register for war and killing, and we object to being forced to participate in the preparations for war and killing. We object to killing innocent civilians, and we object to killing soldiers. We object to nuclear weapons, and we object to conventional weapons. When war comes, many of us will perform peaceful alternative service. Many of us will go to jail rather than compromise deeply held beliefs. But we will not fight. We will not kill. Conscientious objection in this country has always been a part of our national story. In the 18th and 19th centuries, the peace witness, as it were, was almost exclusively conducted by the Quaker and the Mennonite churches of the Anabaptist tradition. And in the Revolutionary War and the War of 1812, and later on in the Mexican War and the Civil War too, Quakers and Mennonites basically would say, I'm not interested in joining the army. And at that time, there were no provisions for anyone who wanted to object. So they either were sent to labor camps or put in jail, or many of them didn't make a public stance, so they were ignored. Some of the peace churches were very quiet about it. They just decided they weren't going to do it and didn't make a big public affair of it. So nothing, there were really no consequences for them. But many of the COs went to jail. In the Revolutionary War, a number of Quaker leaders were sent to a labor camp in Virginia, accused of being British sympathizers by the colonial army, which kind of disappointed me when I heard about that. It kind of throws a wrench into the sort of glorious image that we're taught about the founding fathers and, you know, the American army and how they freed us from tyranny. It really makes you realize that, I guess as human beings, tyranny is a part of our reality, regardless of which side we're on. In the Civil War, there was something called the Substitute Clause, which was really the first provision for anyone who didn't want to go in the war. It wasn't a conscientious objector provision per se. It had to do with someone who, for one reason or another, whether it was family hardship or work-related things, or if you were a minister or a theological student, you could pay someone else to fight for you. The Substitute Clause, it was called. I can't remember how much it was. I think it was $25 in, you know, 1861 money, which was a pretty big fee at that time. The Spanish-American War was pretty much like the Civil War. I think there was a Substitute Clause then, too. I'm not sure how many people took advantage of those in those two wars. I know in the Civil War, it was mostly Quakers, as I said earlier. The first provision for conscientious objectors, that is, people who objected to participating in war or the military institution for reasons of conscience, didn't happen until World War I with the Conscription Act, 1917. And in World War I, basically the government finally gave official approval to what had been happening throughout the previous two centuries, and that is that Quakers, Mennonites, Church of the Brethren, I don't think Jehovah's Witnesses were included in that. Members of churches whose tenets forbade participation in war were allowed to do non-combatant service in uniform. So they were still expected to be in the army, but they could serve as secretaries or medics or cooks or we try. You know, something other than carrying a gun, basically. That brings me up to this fellow's story. He was a Roman Catholic. And the Roman Catholic Church, I'll just read you a little excerpt here. The Roman Catholic Church was one of the most supportive of all the denominations for the war effort. Several of the bishops basically said that not only was conscientious objection unpatriotic, but it was also heretical for a Catholic. And all the mainline Protestant groups, Lutheran, Episcopal, Presbyterian, Methodist, were in that Catholic tradition, as we'll see later, as far as attitudes toward war. So when we're talking about Catholic, I guess with a small c, you know, we're talking about pretty much the tradition that all of us come from, plus all the other mainline traditions. Cardinal Gibbons, who was the cardinal during World War I, basically said that anybody who speaks out against the war is a traitor and should be shunned. And regardless of the fact that Pope Benedictus XV had been trying to work for peace in Europe, Cardinal Gibbons basically said that the pontiff was actuated by lofty motives, but that he was out of touch with reality. And this fellow, Ben Salmon, had been involved in union activity and labor activism before the war, and he saw the issue of labor and the rights of the working classes as related to the issue of conscientious objection and peace, because most of the people who are sent to the front are from the poorer classes. And he knew several people who were drafted and then came back from the war, and, you know, as one fellow told him, we got back and got kicked around like dogs and couldn't get a job and were abused again and again. And I thought of the stories we hear of, you know, the Vietnam veterans, and many of us know people who experienced the same thing. I didn't realize that, that's been the case for a long time. I thought that the Vietnam period was pretty unique that way, but veterans have been abused for a long time. And so Ben Salmon saw those two issues as related. He went to jail because, as a Catholic, he had no option other than combat duty or prison. And his draft board in Denver, because he had been active in a number of local causes, many of the members of the draft board knew him and respected him, even though they disagreed with him. And they said, well, look, we'll make you an exception. We'll let you be an army train clerk, since you worked as a railway clerk before the war. And so they made him several offers of non-combatant service, and his wife and his in-laws pleaded with him to take him. But Ben Salmon's position is moved from what is called conscientious objection to what is called non-cooperation. I'll talk about that later in the third part of the class here. But moving on a little bit, we'll talk about him some more later too. In World War II, the clause which provided for conscientious objection alternatives for Quakers and Mennonites and members of the peace churches, that continued. But a new development in 1942 was the Alternative Service Act, which allowed for conscientious objectors who were not necessarily from a Quaker or Mennonite background to do civilian service, work in a hospital, or there was a work camp in New Hampshire for Catholics. There was about 150 Catholics that participated. But there were still not many COs in World War II, and it was still considered a very unpopular thing to do, you know, and just tantamount to treason. With Korea, the situation didn't change very much, except for the fact that because of nuclear weapons, a number of people, after seeing the destruction that they could do, decided that, well, you know, I want to serve my country, and I'm willing to be drafted and go into the army and fight, but if any nuclear weapons are involved, I don't want to be involved. And so that was kind of a new position, which is called nuclear pacifism. We'll talk about that a little later, too. In Vietnam, finally, the government allowed for a broader base of conscientious objectors. There were a number of Supreme Court cases that were actuated by non-religious objectors. There was one called Seeger versus United States and another one called Walsh versus United States. And both of those young men were people who objected to the war based on ethical reasons, humanitarian. They weren't religious in any way. But And the argument was that, well, even though I don't have a religious background, I should still be able to be exempted. And the cases both were approved. And since then, you don't have to have a religious reason for doing it. Also, finally, the mainline churches, the Catholic and the mainline Protestant churches, towards the end of the Vietnam conflict, not until 1970 or 71, finally said, well, it's okay for a Catholic or a Lutheran or a Methodist to be a CO because of religious belief. So if you think about this fella, it took almost, took more than 60 years, or more than 50 years for his type to be considered legitimate by his fellow members of his church. And that's just sort of mind-boggling to me. You know, if you think about the experiences that fellows like this had to go through before 1970, it's just, it's really upsetting. Imprisonment, solitary confinement. When they got out, they were handed dishonorable discharges, which meant most people wouldn't hire them. And they were shunned from their parish. Many of them had to either leave the church or join other churches, join some of the peace churches. And that was really hard for a lot of these guys. So that brings us up to the present, sort of a brief overview. In 1973 or 74, the draft, per se, was discontinued. Nixon finally brought us out of Vietnam, and President Ford discontinued the draft. And then President Carter, a few years later, granted amnesty to all those who had fled the country because they wanted to avoid conscription. So that sort of closed the legal chapter, and as we know, the emotional chapter goes on with veterans and COs alike from Vietnam. You talk to anybody between the ages of 30 and 40, and you're going to get a lot of feelings about it all, regardless of where they stood on the issue. But then in 1980, after the Soviets invaded Afghanistan, President Carter, to kind of show some American muscle, decided to reinstate not the draft, but registration for the draft. And I was in that first group of men, having been born in 1961, I was in that group that had to register that summer of 1980. And my dad's a captain in the Navy Reserve, so I remember going down to the post office with him, and you know, I said, well, I'll do this, but I don't really feel comfortable doing it. So he said, well, you could put CO on the card and turn it in. So that's what I did. And it wasn't until a few years later that I finally decided that I wanted to do something more than that. So I wrote a statement as to why I was against war, my reasons, and so on. And I got some counseling to help me with that, some draft counseling. Then I asked several important people to write me letters of reference to support my sincerity, one of whom was my dad, who agreed to do it, which was good, because the draft counselors say that the most persuasive letters for the draft board are from those who disagree with you, but who can vouch for your sincerity. And my dad said he'll never make it in the military, so. Thanks, Dad. So, registration still continues. It's been going it's in its ninth year now, and a number of young men, some of whom I know, decided to just not do it. The Selective Service Administration has been sort of lax about enforcing that. They're getting a little stricter. If you go in some movie theaters now, you'll see posters, or in post offices, you'll see posters saying, you know, register within 13 days of your 18th birthday. It's the law. And, you know, a lot of money goes into this program. Although we haven't had a draft, and we haven't had a war, per se, as far as American servicemen and servicewomen on a large scale being sent into an armed conflict, we have had in the 1980s what's called low-intensity conflict, which is definitely a euphemism. And what that means is that the same amount of military equipment and money and supplies goes into the conflict, but without the amount of American personnel. So the war in El Salvador, for example, has been, you know, 80% financed, 90% financed by the U.S. government, and that's been going on since 1982. Also, 1980 also. And that's what the government would consider a low-intensity conflict, despite the fact that, well, 70,000 civilians have died in that war, let alone the soldiers on each side. The invasion of Grenada was another low-intensity conflict. the Middle East situation, the situation with the Contra War, another example of that. We have, like, I would say maybe 7 or 8 LICs going on around the world now, which our government is supporting and paying for. Philippines is another one. We got to know a little bit more about that one when we were in Hawaii in January and realized how similar it is to the El Salvador situation with the factions and the U.S. money supporting the right-wing side and how civilians are really bearing the brunt of it. So that's what's happening now. Registration continues. There's no draft as of yet. But there is a bill in Congress right now proposed by Senator Sam Nunn of Georgia, who is the chair of the Senate Armed Services Committee, called National Service. And what Senator Nunn proposes is that any college student or any high school senior or anyone entering college cannot get financial aid on the federal or the state, he wants state also, cannot get any financial aid on those two levels if they do not perform 2 years of either military service or an approved civilian assignment. And there's a lot of support for it because, you know, there's talk that the youth of today is irresponsible and needs to be disciplined and have that experience to serve their country. And I think there is some merit behind that argument. The bill as it stands now is a little one-sided because the civilian assignments, as they're being proposed, are paid less money than the military assignments. And the recruiting that's going into the military and is much bigger and has a huge budget, whereas the civilian is sort of an afterthought. You know, well, if you don't want to go in the army, you can do something like this. So in rhetoric, the civilian and the military alternatives are equally important, but the way the bill is written, it seems one-sided. So that's kind of an overview of the legal and the historical situation in this country. So we can take a minute now for questions, if anyone has any questions about any of that, then we can move on to part two. Any questions about those, any of the laws or any of the particular conflicts?
I think I heard it right now that legally you can't get financial aid unless you have made that registration.
Yes, there are three amendments that were pushed through by a congressman named Solomon. And they basically began, the first one was more restrictive, and the second one and the third were more expansive. I think I was going to talk a little bit about that later, but I can say something about it now. The Solomon Amendments involve that little voucher when you get financial aid that you have to sign. I don't know whether any of you have had to sign that. We had to in seminary, which kind of surprised me. But I guess in order to get the federal loans for students, you know, all the schools who are involved in those financial aid programs have to comply with that. And that basically says that you can't get the aid on the federal level unless you register. So, as I said before, the Selective Service Administration has been lax about enforcing this. About a dozen young men have been prosecuted, and only about half a dozen have served jail terms since 1980. But they're getting stricter. President Reagan was, towards the end of his administration, I think because of all the other concerns he had, he kind of ignored this one. But I think President Bush is going to pay more attention to this. For COs, they're going to, anybody who wants to be a CO needs to get in touch with their reliefs and start to file a claim for that. So, does that help?
Yeah. What's the, you're going to start to turn 18.
Uh-huh.
And then that per age was...
Current law is 18 to 26. In this guy's time, it was 21 to 31, and he was 28. So if he was around now, he'd miss it. We wouldn't have to worry about it. But in those days, yeah, now it's 18 to 26. In the event of a draft under the current law, 19-year-olds are drafted first. And then they keep going up until everybody up to 26 has been used up, as it were. And then they go to the 18 and a half. It's scary to think about that. I guess Hitler went down as far as 12 towards the end.
And how did it happen that a disproportionate amount of blacks were drafted in Vietnam?
Well, remember that in order...
How did they swing that?
In order to get an exemption, a conscientious objector is exemption under the law, you have to have a legitimate claim, which has been documented as to why you're against the war. And not only that, you have to convince your draft board that you're sincere. And that involves bringing in people to testify for you. And it's a pretty elaborate process. And in the lower income communities, and many of the people of color who drafted came from that bracket, they weren't told anything about this. First of all, there wasn't organizations, most of the draft counseling organizations were geared towards the middle-class white kids. Now that's changing. The Central Committee for Conscientious Objectors and ISPCO, which is where this fellow, the second statement I know where he's from, they have what they call a lower income, a poverty draft program, where they go in and to high schools and they teach kids about that too. But see, the military has a huge recruiting budget and they really make it sound great. And for a lot of these kids, you know, they graduate from high school and they don't have anything. Maybe their grades weren't so hot and they can't get into college. And the military says, we got a great job for you. You know, all you got to do is pass a physical and pass a written test. And you get, you know, such and such a salary per month, and it's usually a pretty good salary. It's better than a lot of other, you know, jobs for that age level. So that's, does that help?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. How soon after you registered as a CO did you need to go through the process of proving your sincerity to the draft board?
You mean when I dealt with it, or just in general?
Well, I guess you could say anyone, but you made it sound as if you put this on your registration card, and then you really didn't have to worry about it for a while.
Well, I didn't because there was no draft. I think in time of draft, there's much more pressure because the longer, the more documented your claim is, the better. And I didn't have any documentation then. I was 18 and I hadn't even thought about it. And that's pretty typical. My uncle, he went in, he was a Huey helicopter pilot in Vietnam. He went in 64, I think, 65. You know, he was goofing off in college and, you know, didn't like school and just wanted to go in and didn't even think about it. And I think that that's more the rule than the exception. So I had an advantage that I had time to sort of mature and think about it more. And I remember what really sparked it for me was thinking about nuclear war. I've never even thought about that. That kind of, the nuclear, what do they call it? That kind of paralyzation that comes over you when you first realize what could happen. When I came out of that, that's when I got involved. I decided, well, I can either sit around and feel sorry for myself or everybody else, or I can do something. But in draft time, when you get your card in the mail, you have 10 days to go and file, go to the post office and say, I want to have a hearing before the draft board. That's not much time. So that's why the organizations which do draft counseling now are encouraging young men to start thinking about it now and start writing down why you're against this if you are against it. And think about what you would want to do. I mean, if you want to go in the Army, that's fine if that's what you really want to do and you thought about it conscientiously. But if not, you know, you don't have much time to do anything else unless you really thought about it.
What if you register and then you want to change it to a CO? Can you do that?
Yeah, you don't have to write. When I wrote it on my card, that just sort of made me feel better.
Oh.
As I was telling Jan, once you receive your draft card, the thing that will be burned, you have 10 days to, and then you can go in and say, this is why I want help. There's a box for conscientious objector. There's two kinds of COs, which I'll explain later.
I don't know if you're going to get into it later, but about the bill regarding our taxes.
Yeah, that'll be later.
Okay.
Yeah, I'm going to talk
about
tax resistance.
Yeah, because that involves everybody.
Mm-hmm.
Our bill is coming out so that even, you know, it doesn't matter how old you are, our tax money is paying for the military. And there's a way that we can get out, but we have to prove, each one has to have our own statement. So, like, even I, as his spouse, cannot just tail in because he's a CO. I have to have my own statement.
Yeah, there's a peace tax fund bill, which is also in Congress. That's sort of the other side of the national service. And we'll talk about that later, because you know, by paying taxes, 40% of it goes to the military right now. So it's, we're all helping, whether we like it or not.
Yeah. I think I got that you're going to mention about the, what different classifications.
Yeah, okay, I'll move on to that. Let me see, what do I do with my little pin? Okay, now when you talk about conscientious objection in a Christian setting, you can get a wide variety of views. Some really against it, some really for. Now, it used to depend on your denomination. I mean, if you went to a Quaker group, you'd pretty much get people supporting it. If you went to a more mainline group, you would get people kind of at least wondering about it, if not against it. Now, that's not so much the case. There's a lot of Catholic parishes and Lutheran and Methodist where those views are welcome. So it's more broad in our base of support. If you look at Christian history and theological developments, there's basically seven. Seven responses towards war. Yeah. It wasn't working earlier. And these seven responses cover the whole gamut of the issue. And all of them have both biblical support and theological support in church history, so it's really a confusing issue when you try to decide, well, as a Christian, what should I do? I'll just write it. Well, the first is what I would call the militarist. And the Christian militarist is one who believes that God works in a unique way through military activity to bring about the redemption of the world. And believe it or not, that there's biblical support for that. The Hebrew Holy War tradition goes back as far as, I mean, as early as Abraham in the battle that he had, and, you know, like Genesis 20, I think it is. And Joshua, thank you. Joshua, you know, destroying the those who were, you know, didn't worship Yahweh, and there's several passages in there where God says, you know, wipe them out, every man, woman, and child, because they have, you know, they have done abominations. You know, they deserve to be destroyed. And there have been Christians in history who've said, you know, they got to be destroyed. Let's kill the heathen. You know, that's how God wants us to do this. The Crusades were an example of that. And today, in some of the churches of what's called the New Right, some of the fundamentalist churches that you see on television and stuff, there's some of this, you hear some of this, if you listen carefully enough. And it's kind of scary. It's especially frightening to me because of the fact that we're living in a nuclear age, and there's some folks that are talking in terms of, well, nuclear war is the purification by fire that God wants. For that. That's going to be our get. We're all going to, some of us would be raptured out and the rest would be destroyed. And so that's the first one. The second one is what I call conscientious participant. This is someone who doesn't believe necessarily that military might is divinely ordained, but is someone who believes that government is divinely ordained. And if the government tells me to go to war, well, God ordained the government, so I'm going to go, regardless of what war it is. And this isn't as extreme as this position. It's more moderate. And there are many, many Christians today who are right here. My brother-in-law, he's sort of a nominal Christian, but this is where he is. He's in the Army Rangers. And he believes, he doesn't believe that war is good necessarily, but he believes that, you know, the President of the United States wants him to do this, and he wants to serve his country, and so that's where he's at. That's conscientious participation. That's someone who has thought about the issue and has decided that God is calling them to serve in this way. Then there's a nuclear pacifist, which I mentioned earlier. That's someone who is they're basically a conscientious participant unless there's nuclear weapons involved or the possibility of using nuclear weapons, then they wouldn't go. So that's, once again, these are sort of listed in order of pro-military up here, pro-war and anti-war down here, so that's how I'm moving. Then there's the selective conscientious objector, and this is the position that is probably the favorite one of the Lutherans and Catholics and most of the mainline churches. This is someone who will not fight in what is considered an unjust war, but will fight as a just war, assuming that there is a just war. Now, a just war goes back to St. Augustine. And in a just war, you're not supposed to attack civilians. You're not supposed to enter the war unless there's a reasonable chance of winning. You're not supposed to really attack anybody except armed soldiers. And then if you defeat them, you're not supposed to attack the prisoners. You're supposed to be good to the prisoners. So don't destroy crops or transportation lines. And it's basically, be a good boy if you're going to be a soldier. And don't, you know, be fair. That's the concern here. And in a just war is one in which innocent civilians are a threat, and so something needs to be done to defend them. And an unjust war is one in which those conditions that I just listed off are not being met. So there's many people who say today, well, if I was around in World War II, I would have fought because, you know, somebody had to stop Hitler. But in Vietnam, I wouldn't have gone because we had the business meeting. That's an example of a selective CO. Okay, then there's conscientious objector. One AO, this is military lingo here. One A means you're available for active duty, active combat duty. You're healthy, you've passed your physical. One A is the classification that most fellows get in the draft.
Can I ask real quick, is the selective conscientious objector is that recognized by the government or not?
No, I'll get to that. Yeah. One, it's not. One AO. This is somebody who is willing to go into the military, but only in a non-combatant capacity. So, as I was saying, World War I, remember, they allowed for that legally. That's when that first became legal, was World War I. Currently, well, let me finish the list. I'm supposed to end here, then I can get to the which ones are legal. Conscientious objector 1-0 is someone who is not willing to participate in the military in any way, but is willing to perform civilian service, hospital, farming. In Vietnam, actually, somebody, you could actually work for some church agencies, too, if you give them credit, which I thought was kind of nice, you know, a nice way to, you know, continue to do ministry and still be true to your conscience. Okay, the last one is called non-cooperator. And a non-cooperator is someone who considers, basically they're the opposite of this. A non-cooperator sees the military as satanic, and therefore will not do anything in cooperation with them at all. And that is where this fellow ended up. He started off here, actually, and then he moved here very quickly. He didn't stay here very long. And he was basically here until his prison experience and the way he saw the COs treated in prison. You know, one fellow wouldn't wear a uniform and work in the prison yard, so they hung him up by his wrists for 12 hours without food. Two guys who came from a sort of an obscure Russian pacifist sect, they wouldn't wear a uniform, and so one of the brothers was put in cold water, his feet were in cold water, and he got pneumonia and died, and they buried him in the uniform. And, you know, that was just typical during this period. It's really upsetting, the brutality, you know, and hysteria that was around then. And so he moved to here, and he decided, you know, I'm not going to do anything. You know, this is really evil, and I'm not going to cooperate with it in any way. And he even reached the point of going on hunger strike. So convinced was he of this, you know, that it was evil. So he wouldn't even eat their food, because to do that would be supporting the satanic institution. Now, the only legal ones at this point are, well, I guess you could say this is legal. Fortunately, most of the top brass in the military are not here. My dad says that most of the real high generals and admirals are actually here, and a lot of them are here. Most of them are here, actually, which is kind of encouraging. And I've met a couple of them. nice guys, you know. I mean, it takes a lot of responsibility to be in their position. I mean, I agree with that. So, but there is some of this in the military. And, I mean, in the lower ranks, they encourage that because, in boot camp especially, because they want you to really like what you're doing. So that's legal. This is legal. This is not legal because this is similar to this. It's selection. And the government says, basically, that if you have to be against war or you're not. And so they kind of allow you to be here and here, and they also allow you to be here. And this is illegal here because you were expected to at least register. This person will not even register. You'd rather go to jail. And like I said, the conservative churches, I guess I could say, are comfortable with these two. Some of the churches aren't comfortable with this. This is really kind of an extreme position. The mainline churches approve of this one and down here. So that's us, the Lutherans, ELCA, Roman Catholics, approve of all this. And then the Anabaptist churches, the Quakers, Mennonites, and Brethren, and so on, they approve of these. So if you look at the Lutheran social statements, for example, you don't see this encouraged at all. Although there are plenty of Lutherans that are here, they're just not recognized. Okay. Any questions about these? These seven responses.
Who are you?
Where am I? Well, I was here, and then I moved up to here. And the reason is I think that there's a lot of good that I can do in a non-military capacity. And I don't know. I mean, part of me thinks that this involves really kind of putting your pacifist beliefs before everything. I mean, everything. Family, everything. And that's where he was. I mean, he was separated from his wife and kids. His wife said, take something. He said, no. His mother said, don't go on hunger strike. For God's sake, don't die. He said, I can't do it. It's what God's called me to do. This is hard, you know. I don't know whether I'm that strong, I guess. And so, this is where I'm at. But I support people that are here. I support people that are here, too. If that's what they've really responsibly thought about. And everything in between. This is the only one that I think is a little wacky. But it's got biblical support. All of them do, really. These folks tend to look towards the Gospels, the Synoptic Gospels especially, with the Turn the Other Cheek, the Sermon on the Mount, Paul's injunction to overcome evil with good, love your neighbor as yourself, when Peter in the garden chops the servant's ear off, in the Garden of Gethsemane, and Christ says, put the sword away, whoever takes it shall be killed by it, you know, whoever takes the sword shall perish by the sword, and so that's where they look to for the biblical support. Then a number of the Old Testament prophecies, you know, looking forward to a nonviolent kingdom of God where all the garments of war will be burned and all the weapons will be turned into farming tools and all that. That's what we're looking to. And these two are there also, but they also recognize that in some cases you need to use force to defend the innocent. And this person will mostly look to the Old Testament. And then maybe Revelation. Okay, any questions more about this stuff? Jan?
You've moved, as you say, from non-cooperative to conscientious objector 1.0. Did you do that because you thought you could be more influential in that other position?
Well, not necessarily. That's a good question.
Well, I met with conscientious objectors in Israel. They're in an organization called Yesh Gavul.
Mm-hmm.
And Rabbi Jeremy Milgram, who has served about 12 years in the reserves, thinks that he can be far more effective or influential if he serves in the reserves but refuses to carry a gun in any capacity.
Right. So he's here, really, huh?
Right.
He's willing to do non-combatant service. Yeah. Yeah, you do interact with more people here. That is a good reason. I hadn't thought about that, but I think I probably agree with you that that's one of the reasons I did it. I hadn't thought about that. When you said influence people, this fellow, they transferred him to 8 different prisons because he kept influencing people. There were several guards he talked to, and they decided they wanted out after they talked to him. And he organized a strike of 700 prisoners in Fort Leavenworth, Kansas, because he worked in the prison commissary and found out that the crops that the prisoners were growing on the prison farm were being sold for profit, and the leftovers were being given to the prisoners. So he spread the word, and the prisoners got angry and went on strike. And there was one time when they were pounding their tableware on the tables for like an hour, and the commandant comes in with all these guards and bayonets telling him to shut up, and they wouldn't do it. And, finally, when they found out who started it, they put him in solitary confinement for, I think, 6 months, no bread and water. And that was over the sewer system with bed bugs and rats. So you can
at that point, I know, you know, in the Vietnam era, a lot of people just left the country because it was looking so fascist, and they nobody felt they could trust themselves.
Yeah, this came out on a big scale in Vietnam.
Was that in any, was that happening like in World War One, or, I mean, why do you stick around to endure prison life?
Well, no, that didn't happen in World War One. People pretty much had faith in America as an example for the world. Remember, here, this was considered the war to end all wars. People really believed that if we defeat the Germans, there's not going to be any world wars. We're going to have the United Nations that came out of World War One, the League of Nations, the Hague Peace Conference. That was all from that period. And that's why, if you look at theological history too, a lot of more well-known theologians during that period really believed that God's kingdom was going to happen here on earth, and, you know, we're going to usher in peace and so on. So when World War II happened, people were really shocked. They didn't know why did this happen? You know, why is there a Hitler? Or not why there's a Hitler, but why did someone put him in jail or an insane asylum? Why did he get so powerful? They didn't understand that. And why were there the death camps? Why the 8-bomb? People just were so... And that's where you start to see Bonhoeffer and people like that saying, you know, the blowing sin is alive and well in your city. They'll always be with us. So, yeah, it wasn't really until the 60s when you had a more general criticism of society. You know, in America is the land of fascism and all that. You heard some voices saying that in World War One.
Also, I'm thinking about Dan's question, and the Berrigans came to mind, and just different people that we've met since I never knew. And there are some people that really believe that the only way you can make a stand or a message to the world overall is by being a non-cooperator. And we've talked a lot about it. It seems like you have to be a particular kind of person. First, you have to like a lot of publicity, and it's got to be a lot of negative publicity.
And you have to kind of be a person who's really comfortable and almost thrives on conflict and not being liked. Like they say, for any of you who have done dysfunctional family studies, they say in every dysfunctional family there's a scapegoat or a problem child or someone who wants negative attention. I read somewhere that someone thought Luther was one of those. Because Luther loved it. You know, he loved debating and being yelled at and yelling back. And I heard that Martin Luther King was considered one of those by some people. You know, you're not afraid of the conflict. That's another reason I couldn't do it. I don't know, I like harmony. And I'm willing, you know, I won't fight, but I'm not a troublemaker. But there are some people who, he was one of those too. He loved it. He loved being out there and just annoying his enemies, you know. But he wanted them to talk too. He wanted to think. So, let's move on. We only have 10 minutes, believe it or not. I have one more section I want to talk about, which is related issues. I can say something briefly about each one. The first is what Cardinal Joseph Bernardin of Chicago has called the seamless garment. Some of you might have... Oh, there's my friend. The seamless garment is the robe that Jesus had when he was crucified, and the soldiers couldn't find a seam to rip it, so they cast lots. It had to stay whole. And if you remember the movie The Robe, you know, that was the robe that... you know, brought Christ's healing power to Victor Mature at Church of Burger. So, seamless garment is the idea that all what Cardinal Bernardine calls the killing issues or the life and death issues, they're all related. They're all the same piece. And he groups all these together. Capital punishment, war, obviously, abortion, active euthanasia, that means lethal injection. That doesn't necessarily mean taking someone off life support systems. It's more, you know, putting someone to sleep, putting them out of their misery. The ACT groups that include this. Euthanasia. Those are the main four. And he says that they're all one piece. For example, the reason that this came out of the whole debate between the left and the right in American politics, in which the right was saying that this is divinely ordained, and this is divinely ordained, but this is wrong. Okay? And then the left was saying, well, this is wrong, and this is wrong, but, you know, we'll allow this, and that's okay, and this is okay. And Cardinal Bernardine said that, you know, they're all the same. You really can't separate them. And that challenged me when I first heard that, because I hadn't thought about it. I was pretty much on the left, and I hadn't thought about it too much. But and obviously, each issue has its own complications. Abortion, you know, you have to decide first whether the fetus, for example, is a life or a potential life, and whether that relates to, you know, the killing that happens in war. And euthanasia also, I mean, that's a really hard issue for family members who are watching someone suffer. It's hard to know what to do there. But, and so, in the seamless garment, I'll just leave it up there. He doesn't suggest that there's a simple answer to each of these situations. But what he says is that he challenges us, I guess, to consider them all part of the same piece. So if you're against war, well, then we'll think about abortion, for example. Can you really be for abortion against war? Or can you be against abortion for war? This is a position that's become popular in Catholic circles in recent years, this decade.
But what it's worth, Martin Luther King had a real similar theory.
Yeah.
It was much broader than Bernardine's, no surprise, but it's the same.
Right. Poverty is one of King grew poverty with that. You know, can you be against war and not be working to help end poverty? Especially since the poor folks are the ones going. Then civil disobedience. This is related to what Don was saying earlier. There are some COs who believe that you not only should not do something, you should not only refuse to cooperate with the military, but you should, in a sense, start your own war, quote-unquote, against the military. So you should go destroy nuclear missile components. You should try to... you should engage in acts of physical violence, not against people, but against military equipment. And so that's... there was one fellow when I was writing this. This was originally a thesis, and I submitted parts of it to different magazines. And this one guy who was in prison wrote me a letter saying, I want a copy of your thesis. I'm in prison in Virginia for hammering nuclear missile heads in Florida. And I thought that was amazing. I'm like, how did that guy get that? So that's another issue related to this. There are some COs who don't believe that that's part of what they're called to do, and there are others who do. In the Bay Area, there's a continuing protest against the trains going out from the Concord Naval Weapons Station, which bring the weapons to El Salvador and Central America. And there's always people sitting in the tracks, and they are protesting.
And some of it's violent, some.
Some of it's just getting arrested. So that's the second issue. Third is war tax resistance, which Don talked about earlier. Currently, women do not have to deal with conscientious objection and being exempt from and worrying about the draft because they're exempt. But women and men, young and old, black and white, everybody pays taxes. You know, for every dollar you pay, 40 cents goes to the military. And so if you... And Ben Salmon solved that problem by not even eating military food. which is what he suggests. He says, you know, this is really hard to do, basically. I haven't decided what I'm going to do about this. But there is a bill in Congress called the Peace Tax Funding Bill. And this would allow for anyone, regardless of age or gender or whatever, to start a CO claim. And you'd have to go through the same process as any young man fronting the draft, saying why you're against war. And you know, there's a lot of mothers, actually, that lost sons in Vietnam that are supporting this.
And what's the provision on that?
The provision here is that if you are deemed to be a sincere, conscientious objector, the portion, that 40% of your taxes will go to peaceful purposes and of your choice, I think. It's of your choice. There's several options. There's United Nations, there's domestic projects of your choice, Peace Corps.
Peace University.
Yeah, and right, yeah. Programs, peace studies programs.
They're not counting on half the population doing this, right?
No.
Since a bill hasn't gone through, is it possible to go through the process of getting CO status now?
No, it's not. That's why it's still, it's like the national service for the conservative side. They're trying to, the peace side is trying to push this through, and the more military side is trying to push the other through, so they're kind of competing with each other. I think that there's a chance that they'll both pass. The National Service Bill has a lot of support in Congress. But Ron Dellums, I know, from California, there's several Congress people who support this, too. Because there's a lot of people who have been doing tax resistance. Unfortunately, the IRS is one of the most highly staffed and highly funded federal agencies. And if you don't pay, they'll get you. And it's really hard because they'll take away your car and your house. And there's just no qualms at all about that. So I support this. I got the newsletter. There's an address for them in the dining hall. I think there's some literature for that, if you're interested.
And also, if you're interested, write that you're in support of the bill.
Yeah, write to your congressperson and say, look, I'm a CO. Okay, and then... the last two, one of which I've already talked about, filing a CO claim. You need to first pray, first of all. And I remember when I first confronted this, I had a lot of feelings, but I wasn't sure what they all meant. So I prayed about it, and then out of the prayer process, which took several months, and thinking about the war issue, I things started to become clear. So, reasons why I was against war, authors that have been important to me, etc. And you need to write down a statement. It needn't be long. It could be one page, three pages. And be really honest about yourself, and don't say anything that you're not willing to back up with your own actions or whatever. Say what you're willing to do and what you're willing not to. Say what you're willing to go to jail for. And it's really a process of getting in touch with your deepest values. And the government, they can tell if you're sincere. If you really hold them deeply, they're not going to, they're going to respect that. I have faith in that. And then the letters of support, get the letters of support from people who have known you and known your process of development, your pastor, your family members, friends. Include a few that don't necessarily agree with you. And file all this stuff at a draft counseling agency, and I have some addresses if anybody's interested. There's about three people. Then the last one is something that my wife has helped me learn about, and that's nonviolent parenting. Soldiers and militarists are created from a very young age. Every time you hit your child, you're encouraging a certain message, really. Not that that's hard not to do, it's hard to be a parent. But there are certain ways of parenting that encourage a more interactive, nonviolent, and relationship-centered style of maturing. And there's other ways of parenting which enforce a more authoritarian, sort of right or wrong type style of maturing. And this is a real new issue. And a lot of people in the peace movement haven't really seen the connection here yet. but it's really important when it starts. Any questions? I mean, it's already 5. I know we're late. If anybody needs to go to first setting, you can leave now. Otherwise, I can hang around for questions and comments.
There's some good books on parenting.
Okay.
Parenting for Peace and Justice.
Oh, really?
There's a few in the bookstore.
Great. Yeah, I don't know very much about it at all. It's an issue that I'm just starting to...
There's a whole rack in this bookstore.
Yeah.
And there's stuff in child education that's, I mean, as a preschool teacher, I've been involved in it ever since the beginning. There's a lot you can do in working with kids, working with each other. Kids hit all the time, and working with that.
Mm-hmm. Anna Maria, did you want to say something about the German situation? I know it's slightly different over there.
Do you have that kind of national service?
Yeah, it's required. Yes, we have national service and adopted. When you are out of school, so when you go further to university, then they can get you up to when you assess 27. And people who have to serve in the army have to do it for 18 months, and the COs have to do it for 22 months, and they also get paid less than the ones who are in the service. And the same is true in Germany, that many unemployed people want to go to the army because they get good education there, and they can learn trades, and they can get a driver's license or whatever. And many of them take up a duty that they serve in the military for 2 or 7 or 9 years.
Mm-hmm.
And the other thing I wanted to know is, in Germany, if you do social services, the government is really dependent on that.
Yeah.
If there would be a bill that there's no no social services, then the whole system would collapse.
Right, they're dependent on the COs.
Yeah.
Does the society have an appreciation of that contribution, or is it just sort of a...
Yes, I think so.
Okay. Yeah.
Who is valued more, the person who serves in the military as a